Mrs. Lister? Mr. Kelly?
May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Tony Lister in this appeal from his sentence. Mr. Lister was sentenced to 33 years, a little more than 33 years, after pleading guilty to distributing 36 grams of cocaine base. On the basis of his crime of conviction alone, the sentencing guidelines would have advised a sentence of no more than 87 months. Our position in this appeal is that the 405-month sentence that was actually imposed upon Mr. Lister is unreasonable and that it violates due process because the extra 26 years that were imposed to punish relevant conduct constitutes a tail that wags the dog of sentencing, and because the procedural safeguards at sentencing were inadequate to assure the accuracy of the facts upon which that relevant conduct finding was based.
But you know, in Booker, when the Supreme Court said in the remedial opinion that the guidelines were still to be used as an advisory structure for sentencing, it is inconceivable that when Justice Breyer wrote those words, he didn't have 1B1.2, among other things, in mind. Few people know more about the guidelines than he does. And so, without saying that I'm always in love with relevant conduct, the fact is relevant conduct is part of the structure of the guidelines. Thousands and millions of sentences have been based on that. And if your attack is on using relevant conduct at all, I really think it's hard to maintain that in light of what the court said in Booker.
Your Honor, my attack is not on using relevant conduct at all. My position with regard to the reasonableness of the sentence and the due process attack is that...
So is your attack that 1.8, whatever it was, 6886 kilograms shouldn't... with his criminal history, shouldn't be at that point in the grid?
My attack is twofold. One is that the procedural safeguards at sentencing were not adequate to allow such a dramatic enhancement of the sentence on the basis of relevant conduct.
Booker, it just has to be a reasonable sentence. I thought
true.
Your better argument would be, I don't know if it prevails, but that the judge didn't do enough with, what is it, 3553A. Has a bunch of factors about proportionality and so on, and so I thought that was your concern.
Okay. Well, that certainly is.
Right, because he made the sentences within the statutory maximum, post Booker. He calculated the guideline sentence, and then he, decided it was reasonable. Now, you have to show, it seems to me, you have to show somehow that it's not reasonable under those statutory sentencing factors.
Well, this is a sentence that was imposed before the Supreme Court's decision in Booker, and the judge didn't have the benefit of Booker's remedial decision.
But the only thing that I think bears on this from Booker is that the statutory factors remain mandatory, and judge has to consider them. So a lot of judges, decided, saw Booker, the handwriting on the wall, so they would say, I've computed the guideline sentence, but I'm also going to consider a sentence I would impose if they weren't mandatory. And if the judge, in doing that, touches enough of the bases in 3551A, then we uphold his sentence.
And I would certainly agree on the basis of the Booker decision that judges are required to look at more than the guidelines. They're required to look at all of the factors that are identified in 3553A.
So which of the factors would you, if you had the opportunity to be back before Judge Shabazz, emphasize for Mr. Lister?
Well, I would certainly emphasize, as I did in my brief, the disparity between the sentence that was imposed upon Mr. Lister and the fact that his co-actors or co-defendants got no sentence at all.
Although you run into the buzzsaw of prosecutorial discretion there, don't you?
Well, we do, but it's prosecutorial discretion certainly isn't ruled out as a factor in producing sentencing disparity in 3553A. So I think it's something that the judge can certainly look at. Racial disparity between cocaine, powder cocaine, and crack cocaine is something the judge can look at.
I think what Judge Wood is suggesting is that if the government decides to reward with a, you know, proposing a discount, right, someone who's cooperated, if that has a kind of domino effect and all the co-defendants have to get their, have their sentences reduced proportionately, that undermines the government's strategy, you know, of trying to pick off some of the defendants and get their cooperation, use it against the others.
That may be, but I don't think that a sentencing judge has to give the government the benefit of that strategy. I think after Booker, a sentencing judge is entitled to say...
I don't think a sentencing judge can disrupt, you know, the whole basic structure of prosecution, which is to make a deal with some of the conspirators in order to nail the others. I don't think the court can say, well, if you make a deal with one of the conspirators, you have to treat all the others just as well.
Oh, I agree. I don't think that, that the court can tell the prosecutor what to do, but I think the court can say, in light of what the prosecution did, it's not fair.
No, that's what I'm saying. He can't say, right? He can't say that because the government went easy on one conspirator, all the others have to get light sentences.
I don't
that's
think...
That's not in the cards.
Well, I think the judge can exercise discretion in deciding what's fair.
No, that's not in the cards. That's not in the cards.
And I think 3553A instructs the judge to be fair.
That's your best argument.
The other argument that I have...
Yeah, that's your best argument. It's that the sentence doesn't sound fair. It sounds
No. The other argument that I haven't gotten to yet, and what was going to be my initial argument, is that the court misapplied the guidelines in the first place in denying Mr. Lister credit for acceptance of responsibility. The defense made a reasonable argument at sentencing that the government failed to call a witness, a police detective who took a statement from Mr. Lister, to explain what that statement meant. We argued that there was ambiguity in that statement and that an alternative reading of the statement was that Mr. Lister was talking about acts that were not relevant conduct, acts that occurred prior to his arrest in 1998.
Maybe you can explain this to me a little bit, because when I looked at this statement, Mr. Lister, who's talking in 2004, refers to something that happened 5 years ago, which, unless I'm really wildly off on math, means 1999. And his other conviction was 98. And it did seem to me frivolous to say that something that happened in 1999 happened before his 1998 conviction.
The statement talks about things that also happened 9 years ago. The statement uses words like approximately and about. It was our position.
But he says he
talks about dealing marijuana after a time frame that starts in approximately 2000 or 1999.
But I thought that it said that the 2004 statement said he began selling ounce quantities of crack or cocaine base or whatever approximately 5 years ago, and that means 1999. And so, I mean, I think I think the district court thought that, which is why the district court thought that it was frivolously denying relevant conduct, not just, you know, keeping your mouth shut or in some serious way denying relevant
conduct. Well, the word approximately, I think, brings 1998 within the scope of the time frame, and 1998 wouldn't be considered relevant conduct, or at least it wasn't in the pre-sentence report and wasn't argued by the government, because Mr. Lister had already been punished in 1998 for his 1998 drug conduct. Even if the argument that the defense made wasn't accepted, Mr. Lister did not adopt that argument. He didn't say that he understood or agreed with the argument.
You know,
and this court in Purchess said that unless the defendant adopts or takes moral responsibility for the argument that his defense lawyer makes, that is not a denial of acceptance of responsibility.
No, I understand that. But what Mr. Lister says in the transcript repeatedly is, I rely on my lawyer for that, right?
Yes.
If what Mr. Lister had said is, my lawyer speaks for me, then I take it you would agree that that's an adoption of whatever the lawyer is saying, you would not. Because it seems to me a lawyer is an agent of the client. And when he says, I rely on my lawyer for that, I think the issue for us is trying to decide whether that means I'm adopting what my lawyer says or whether that means I'm not saying anything.
Well, I think that assumes a level of sophistication on the part of criminal defendants that I rarely see.
Oh, lawyers, he must have been instructed on this, surely.
Lawyers don't...
No. He must have been told to say this.
Obviously, I can't comment on what he was told or not told by his counsel.
I think it's something to think up by yourself.
But the...
It doesn't sound like the diction that you would expect. But anyway, be that as it may, at the moment, we just have to decide what that means. Right.
And if what it means, and what I think it means is, hey, my lawyer represents me, that's what he does. I don't think that's an adoption of what the lawyer is saying. I think he's saying, I leave it up to my lawyer. I don't understand law. I'm not a lawyer myself. This is the guy who's in charge. This is the guy who's making the arguments. I just let him do it. That's not adopting the argument, and that's not taking moral responsibility for what the lawyer says, which is what Purchase requires.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Anderson?
Good morning. My name is Robert Anderson. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney responsible. I have the privilege of representing the United States in this matter. The primary questions dealing with the reasonableness later, the primary questions we have to get to first are were the guidelines applied correctly? Then we can look at, put more in context, the reasonableness of the sentence. Did the court correctly apply the guidelines denying him acceptance of responsibility? And did the sentencing violate any due process rights where the court calculated the guidelines based on the defendant's own statements, uncontested statements about the quantities that he dealt in, which were corroborated by the government's witnesses? The secondary question is then the reasonableness of the sentence, as I said. The one common denominator that you have in those first two issues, the acceptance responsibility and the whether the sentence was applied properly in compliance with due process, is Lister's own statement. And looking at the record and the arguments that are advanced in the briefs, Lister's own statement to the police was about drug quantity he dealt in, the time frame he dealt in with the government's witnesses. In all this in the context of they arrest him, he gives a statement to them in May of 2004, and that statement to the police, using that date as a time reference when they're talking to him, he's saying, well, okay, 2 years ago I did this. 5 years ago from this day, I did this. Now, unless we're using new math, 2004 minus 5 years is 1999.
I think what bothers me more about this, Mr. Anderson, is this, I rely on my lawyer for that.
Sure.
I think the court gave up too quickly. The court gets to the point of saying, then you don't agree with him. Is that what you're saying? Lister says, yeah. I basically just rely on him for it. But it seems to me the judge gets off on the wrong track where he asks a question about the lawyer's advice to the client instead of everybody's interrupting everyone, and the judge, I think if he had nailed down that last point, are you accepting the challenges as offered by your lawyer? Lister says, I basically just rely on him, and the judge should have said, you have to answer yes or no. Is this you speaking, or is this the lawyer speaking? He never does that. It just sort of, goes off in this other track, and it's left up in the air.
Right. Well, it's clear. Clear from the context.
Not clear.
Of the record. That's not clear. But it's clear from the context of the record that the court was trying to comply with the Purchase opinion, because the court was very familiar with the Purchase opinion,
yes,
and was trying to comply with that, trying to get to, does he exhibit? Is he really knowledgeable about what his attorney is doing? He asked him directly, "Do you adopt what your attorney is saying?" And he got what it seemed to the court is a purposely evasive answer. I'm not going to say yes or no, because if I say I don't agree with what my attorney's doing, I'm not going to get the benefit of that not being counted as relevant conduct if he if you agree with my
attorney. That's a fairly intelligent position to take, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't it's a fairly intelligent position for the defendant to take?
Yeah.
You weren't really suggesting that Shabazz or Judge Shabazz was out of the deep kindness of his well-known kind heart, reaching in to give some reason to reduce the sentence to to accord him the acceptance of responsibility?
Well, it was, as we know, it is the defendant's burden to establish
Was the government's position at the time of the sentencing that this was an appropriate sentence?
The sentence that Judge Shabazz imposed?
That's the only sentence that's before us, friend.
Yes. Yes. Now, we did point out he didn't dispute, as I said, he didn't dispute the facts about the quantity he dealt in. He didn't dispute dealing with Sims.
Well, we're talking about the amount of the sentence, not the amount.
The sentence? We didn't dispute the sentence.
No. Did you agree with the sentence then? We're back to what he just did. Not that you can accept what happened at trial. I want to know, did you dispute the thing? Did you agree with it? Did you say, yes, that's an appropriate sentence, Your Honor?
We agreed with the guideline calculations at the court.
No. You've done it again. I understand the guideline calculations. It's left to his discretion.
Right.
Did you think that did the government take the position that he appropriately exercised that discretion in this sentence, in this case?
Yes.
And that's...
Well, you wouldn't have recommended a sentence that severe, would you have?
Recommended a sentence of what?
That severe.
Well,
what... The judge has said to you, what would be a good... What do you think we should sentence this guy?
As used to happen constantly, does the government have a recommendation of sentence?
Well,
Response have been...
I've never, in the federal system, never, since I've been working in it, never got...
There
the ability to make a choice of what...
There's no institutional memory left. But the fact
there you go.
The federal system has always been by the guidelines. As long as the guidelines are correctly calculated.
I've been involved with the federal system on a constant basis for something over 35 years as a prosecutor, trial judge, and court of appeal judge. But before the guidelines, it was one of the things we always asked. And the guidelines are relatively new. But I was wondering just exactly what would have happened if... Were you the trial lawyer?
Yes.
If the judge had turned to you and said, what does the U.S. attorney recommend as a sentence? Do you have any recommendation?
I would have relied on what the guidelines... Because I
But the guidelines are discretionary.
I understand. But
you love the guidelines.
We all
can't think outside the guidelines. They're so...
You embrace them entirely.
I've
lived with them
DNA
for so long.
And children will
and
buy the guidelines.
I think they should have driven a stake through the heart of the guidelines back when they invented them, but that's not the point. The point is, even though he's in the guidelines, he can exercise discretion. So they're only advisory. And I want to know whether you think he abused his discretion.
No, sir. His sentence was reasonable. He even indicated in sentencing him, he was inclined, without those guidelines, to impose the maximum sentence. And there are some people, there's a purpose for the maximum sentences.
I'm not shocked by that comment of the trial judge.
And here he allowed the guidelines to temper that.
But you know, there's something funny. This is not what you'd call a major dealer, would you, this man?
Well, the quantity of cocaine base dealt in what Sims and Gosha had indicated 4 to 5 kilograms of cocaine base, and that's not what we used
over
as a sentencing factor.
Over what period?
Over the 2000 to 2000, the period of the conspiracy, 2000 to 2002.
So 2 kilograms a year?
That's what they had estimated.
This is not 11 pounds.
This is not a big guy. I mean, what is funny, you know, we have this concept of marginal deterrence, and you have to... sentences that are proportional in some ways. Otherwise, people decide, well, I'll commit the worst possible crime. So if this fellow gets 30 years plus, what do the big shots get if you ever catch them?
Shoot them right in the courtroom. Don't wait for them to go out.
Now, Mr. Gosha said, Mr. Gosha lived in the Madison area. Lister's down in the Beloit area, and he said Mr. Lister was one of the main suppliers of cocaine base up in the Madison area.
The drug
Madison,
dealers are way ahead of the American public on this point because they've gone metric. But you know, if you had 2 bags of flour sitting in front of you, that's the amount of crack he dealt with over a 2-year period of time. 5 kilos, it's 11 pounds. It's nothing. As Judge Posner says, there are people like with airplanes full of this stuff.
With the cocaine hydrochloride, sure, cocaine powder is dealt in much more quantity. Cocaine base, the crack, which involves these higher penalties.
It cooks up to a pretty equivalent amount, though, so I'm
Mr. Sims was cooking it up
records.
To
records.
Mr. Sims was cooking it up to an almost equivalent amount.
Right, so it's not very much. I mean, if you had an airplane full of powder cocaine, you could convert that into an awful lot of crack.
That's correct. And of course, there's with every dealer who's supplying the stuff, you know, we sometimes chip the tip of the iceberg. We don't know all the people he may have been dealing with.
So you just sentence everybody to 35 years and kind of call it a day?
Right.
Or
no. Sort them out later. I mean,
right.
No. Well, actually, when there are people who are above that quantity even, Mr. Lister's sentence, only the maximum was 40 years, it could have been as much as life.
Well, 40 years in life, depending on your age, can be rather equivalent sentences.
It's life to some people at that point.
How old is he?
Late 20s or early
30s. He was born in 1975, I think.
75, so he'd be late 20s at that time, at the time he was sentenced. Mm-hmm. But I think the important...
He'll be considerably older when he gets out now.
The important thing here, with regard to the purchase opinion...
Medicare.
I'm sorry?
He'll be out in time for Medicare.
Yeah. I think what's important here is the sort of cat and mouse game that the defendant was playing with the court, and unlike in the purchase opinion where he didn't understand, Mr. Purchase didn't understand English, didn't have much of an education. Those facts are contrasted with Mr. Lister, who has an education, understood English well, and
didn't he work in a men's clothing store?
He owned it was part owner in a men's clothing store.
A men's clothing store.
Part owner in it, and that. Also pegs the time frame. He said he was
the judge didn't buy suits or anything from him. He had he made the pants too long or something and irritated him.
No, sir. But that pegs the time frame of exactly in his admissions what he was doing. And it's clear that he was not doing this in the early 90s or mid 90s. This is really in the 2000 to 2004. And his denial of that fact, his evasiveness, really betrays his lack of acceptance of responsibility.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. And thank you, Mr. Kelly. So we'll move on to our last case, Salikov versus